My name is Carla Lewis. The date is February the 26th, 2007. I am interviewing Dr. Florence Saunders Farley. Okay. Dr. Farley, when and where were you born?
I was born on May 28, 1928 at 518 Loudoun Avenue, Northwest Roanoke, Virginia.
Tell me about your parents, your brothers or sisters, or did you have extended family?
Oh, no, I had enough of my first family. I didn't need to have any extended family, but I guess we did, basically, when you think about it, because my mother and her brother, who had children, were extremely close. So my cousins were very much like sisters and brothers. My aunt was very much like another mother. So I guess in a way we think about that as an extended family. But my mother was a, a very, very beautiful, visionary, bright woman there were 10 of us. So I was the 9th child of 10 children. And we always talked about the fact that there were two families, my older brothers and sisters, and my younger sister and brother and niece, who was reared as a sister to us. And so my mother, by the time I came along, was a very relaxed person who just enjoyed life and who interacted with her children in such a very comfortable way, because as she said, she had already reared children, and she knew she'd know how to be a mother. And therefore, she just kind of, as we used to say, let the good times roll. So I was fortunate enough to be born into a family, a large family, and had all the benefits nearly of being an only child, or in a very small child family, because it was only my sister, and my brother was maybe 5 or 6 years older than I, and so he was kind of out of my range. My mother was a married when she had her first child when she was 16 years old. And so when we start talking about young women having babies of today, we don't understand, I guess, the dynamics again of her, the fact that her mother kind of took the oldest of my mother's children in and taught her how to mother. So the grandmother did a lot of that with them. My mother, Kate, was born in Danville, Virginia, and she came to Roanoke. She finished her education in Roanoke, and at that time, black children only went to the 8th grade in Roanoke. Public school education was 8th grade, and my mother was taught by Miss Lucy Addison. And many of the principles that Miss Addison taught her as a child, as a student, my mother taught us. For example, if we would ask my mother how to spell a word, and she would say to us, go to Mr. Webster. And our dictionary sat in a high chair, my baby sister's high chair. And once she got large enough not to use the high chair, the dictionary sat in that high chair in that same place. And anytime we had to spell or be doing homework and all, we knew that that's where we would go. That was our little library for the dictionary. And we would go to the dictionary, but she would tell us just quickly, check with Mr. Webster, and we would go to Mr. Webster. So she was fascinating and tell many tales about my mother and her whole style of mothering and her relationship with us being students and how she encouraged and worked with us in that domain. She always said that the girls could bring A's and B's home, and the boys could bring A, B's, and C's. So I don't know why she was so sexist, but anyway, she was. So she would let them do a little less than we. And also, she would love that. My father was very, very interesting person. He was born in Radford, Virginia.
Can you give me his name?
Statius. My father's name was Statius Thaddeus Saunders. And we thought that was an interesting name, because no other children in school had my daddy's name. And my mother's name was Neota. Nobody else had her name, Neota Florence. And I have her name, and I'm very proud of that. And she was Neota Florence Saunders. She was aware her maiden name was Aware. My grandmother, as I said, was nothing but a matriarch. She was, she just directed her children's families, their lives, and so forth. So she was a kind of interesting, fascinating woman also. My father was a follower of Marcus Garvey. And so I know from childhood about the Black Star and the ship and all. We had pictures in the house of all of that. And he was very, very uncomfortable in the South as a Black man. He didn't feel that he could make the kind of money that he wanted to rear his children and to do for his family. And he was the baby in his family. So he would go to Pittsburgh, where he had older brothers, and work in the steel mills. And they made extremely good money in the steel mills, but just periodically, when the South became too much for him, he would go north, and he would go to Pittsburgh, and he'd work, and we'd stay here. And my mother kept us, and he sent, you know, money home every 2 weeks for all of us and everything. So we had to live, but my father just wasn't home. One wasn't there, but that was because he just could not tolerate the South. And so he would do that and come back home, and we'd cry and love him up, and he loved us dearly, and we had a good time. But it was an interesting kind of beginning. My mother was devoutly Christian and Baptist at that, and my father was just non-religious, and so on Sundays I used to have a choice. Sometimes I would go to Sunday school, but the other times I'd go with my father. We would walk downtown, and he would show me all the clothes in the store and talk to me about a whole array of things, and so he had a big influence on my life and a lot of attitudes that I have and all I got from him. And I guess it's good I had my mother's controlling things, because I guess I'd been wild as a buck if I hadn't. Some people sound wild anyway, so who cares?
Okay. Did you all sit on the front porch and listen to the radio, or do you remember your telephone?
We didn't have a telephone. We lived in the middle of the block. My grandmother lived on the corner, okay? And my grandmother lived with my Uncle Alfred. My Uncle Alfred worked for the railroad, and he worked for the Northwestern Railroad. And so she lived there. She dominated him, as I said. She was in charge of everybody. And so she had, my mother was the only girl in the family. And my mother's brothers just kind of worshipped her. And so they did a lot of providing for us, his nieces and nephews. So the telephone was at my grandmother's house. In my early childhood days, we got a telephone, I guess, when I got to be a teenager, later, much later in life. But so my grandmother, so we spent... We were supposed to do chores at her house, and of course we would go down to do the chores and get on the telephone, and she couldn't get us off, and she was threatening to tell our mother and all, and then it would get to be dark, and we would say, well, we got to go home because it's dark, and we'd run, and we never did scrub the floor, we never did make the beds, we never did, we were bad children. But anyway, that's the way we did, my poor grandmother. But she had a telephone, so we could go down, we went down there, and we used that telephone. And as I said, that's when we were using them, when we weren't supposed to use, like all of the children doing now. And the front porch was just an extension of the house. And so you were there, you had nice front porch furniture, and, you know, so just as you would have nice furniture in your house, and you took in the pillows at night, and somebody had that chore, everybody had a job to do around everything. And so those little pillows couldn't sit out and get all the dew and all the... if it rained and all of that. So you had to bring in the pillows that were on the glider, and we had a swing and all of that. So, no, we didn't listen to the radio on the porch. You wouldn't dare. That was something else I think that people had to miss. The porch was more like your sitting room, you know. But, again, in my day, you didn't eat anywhere but in the kitchen or dining room. So you weren't eating on the porch, and you weren't listening to a radio on the porch. It wasn't that kind of thing. It was a place for social interaction among people. So we didn't have all this artificial stuff like the radio. So we didn't listen to radios on porches. That would not have been proper. Okay. And we were very proper Southern people.
Okay. I didn't mean on the front porch. I meant this. Did you listen to the radio? A lot of times, if people would gather around the radio.
Well, that was right. We listened to the radio every night. That was a family affair. Okay. Yeah, right. Yeah, that was a family affair, and we had our programs that came on at night. We got our homework done. We do our homework quickly because if it was a certain night. I remember a show like The Inner Sanctum and all that kind of stuff. Then we got up in my mother's room on the bed. And the radio was up there, and it was the family got sat around and listened to the radio. And again, that was another place that you learn things from your parents, you know. And all of us would get in there. And in my family, we didn't eat dessert after meal. Dessert was basically special. My mother made dessert every night, but you didn't eat it until later in the evening. So after we had done our homework. And we won't listen to the radio. Then we had our dessert.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you have family stories that were passed down from generation to generation that you still tell today to your family members?
Yeah, we always shared stories, you know, yeah. But, as I said, like Miss Addison, we thought we knew her because my mother had told us so much about her and different things that we would do in school that she would relate and that she would tell. And like, for example, my mother told us stories of her childhood. And we still do tell them. For example, with the library, my mother, I became just an avid library goer. I just went every day in the library. And of course, it was similar to what my mother did. You know, because she said that the library in her day was at a store, and it was in the back of the store, and I don't remember the name of the store and where it was located, but it must have been maybe in West End somewhere or in the center of Roanoke or something. But she said that you would go to that store and that the man had books and all. And she tells a story when she was pregnant with me. She says that there was some place across the railroad track, which would be like up in Southwest, a store. And on Fridays, it was a cereal. And so every week the cereal came out. And she said she would send my brother over on Fridays and to pick up this cereal. And they also gave you a dish or some piece of china. And it's like a luncheon set. And so I have all pieces of that myself now. And that's all connected to this luncheon set that she collected while she was reading this book. And my middle name is Therese. And that was the heroine of that book, of that story. So she named me the middle thing. So we have a lot of stories in our family that we tell and we pass down to the children. We've always been a family of readers. Everybody in my family were read, you know. And so she would often tell us those stories, but that was very close to me because that's where I got my middle name. And remember, she would say, your name is not Teresa, it is Therese.
Okay. What is your fondest memory of childhood? You had many, mm-hmm. I know, but did you have one that just stuck out, like
well,
a holiday
you know,
maybe?
Or? Well, you know, we just had, you know, growing up was just fun. It was just delightful. It was just easy, you know, when you think about it. I think one of the things that, you know, we had Sunday school, like I told you, we went to everybody's Sunday school for their summer vacation Bible school. Mm-hmm. So we could just go from one church to the other and do that, and that would fill up our Sunday. And we look forward to that, and we learn things, you know, it was part of it. We had plays at school, and you learn your part. I remember I was Becket Thatcher in Huckleberry, Tom Sawyer, and I played the part of Becket Thatcher. And, you know, it was, you got all your stuff together, and my sister Ludie and Bobby, they were tiny tots, and they were on the radio. And the whole the I guess what I love more about it was that we lived in a community, mm-hmm. and everybody was involved in everything. Mm-hmm. And so Ludie was the announcer for the Tiny Tots, and Bobby was singing on the Tiny Tots. And on every Saturday morning, these little black children came on the radio. And the whole community would say, did you hear the Tiny Tots? And so-and-so sang this, and so-and-so did this and all. And you, as I said, we were in plays, and everybody was involved. The WCA, and I learned, how parliamentary procedures, they make you be the secretary, and you had to learn how to take minutes. And the next time, it wasn't this thing about who they elected. It rotated. So that all of us could get those kinds of experiences. And I remember one of the things I guess will always stick with me, basically, is the fact that the first person that I saw with a PhD degree was right here in Roanoke at Jerusalem Baptist Church. And the pastor of Jerusalem Baptist Church was Dr. E.T. Brown. And his wife was Rose Butler Brown. And Rose Butler Brown had gotten her PhD from Boston University. And I was at church that Sunday with my mother. And Reverend Brown said that his wife was Mrs. Brown is here today. But I want you all to know her name has changed. She's a doctor. And he said, she's not a medical doctor. So if you have any pains or anything, he says she's a doctor who knows all about the head, because she had her degree in educational psychology. And so they had a reception for her afterwards. And I remember getting in line and marching up to her. And my mama said, tell her your name, Florence. And so she said, let the child speak for herself. And I did, and I was so happy that somebody could get my mama and tell her, and I could get away with doing it, and so I did. Would you believe that years and years and years later, I got a PhD in educational psych, and more importantly, she taught at Virginia State in the same psych department that I became the chairman of, that I went to study in, and I became the chairman of. I didn't have any idea that women couldn't do anything. You know, I had saw her. Sadie B. Lawson was at principal the year I was a thing. So when I got out of this little cocoon of Roanoke and found out that people said that education wasn't something that black people desired, and I realized, I said, that's all we knew, and that women didn't do anything, or that smart kids didn't want to be smart, if there was a stigma for that. Just like I was telling you about Popeye and all those boys, they tell you in a minute, they weren't as they said, quick and fast as I was with the books, but they never put me down. They went on, and the teacher let them help, you know, we helped each other and we moved on. So a lot of the negative things that they say about us as a people, it's good you're doing the history, mm-hmm. because I don't know anything about it. I have no idea about it. And so we need to rewrite history and tell them, oh no, that's not what we were about as a people.
Okay. Do you remember having a family vacation?
Yeah. Our family vacation was at Norfolk and Western Picnic they had every year. Yeah, that was our vacation. We all went, got cute little shorts and little sandals and all of that, and packed up all the food in the world. It was the best food in the whole wide world. And if your people worked on the Norfolk and Western Picnic, you went for free. And if they didn't, and I don't know where these little places were, but we got on the train and we went to the place and we sat and spent the whole day. And that was one of them. That was one of the summer vacations we had, okay? Another big thing we did was the fair would come every year. And so you had Children's Day at the fair, and you saved your money, and everybody got the money together, and all your uncles and aunts and cousins and everything gave you money, and you just had a big day at the fair. So yeah, those were the kinds of vacations. My daddy used to take us to ball games in Cincinnati. Again, working on the railroad, you could get a free passes from Roanoke to Cincinnati. So I can remember one trip that we did that way, and all. And then in the summer, our relatives came back to Roanoke, and that was a celebration. And always you had, Mama would cook for days, and they would come and visit, and everybody had fun. So it was a lot of different ways of having vacations, if you like, and a lot of things to do during vacation time.
What are the chores did you do around your house?
You said, as I told you before,
everybody had chores.
All of us had chores, and I spent most of my time getting out of them.
Okay.
We had to wash dishes. Okay. On Christmas Day, after we gotten all the gifts and everything, or during that Christmas break when you're away from school, we would get the new calendar and put down every day who had to wash dishes and who had to dry them. You did dishes in teams. So one person washed and one person dried. And we would know for the whole year who was supposed to wash dishes and who was supposed to dry dishes. So we took the big old calendar from Norfolk and Western, and you put the names down, and that was wash and you dry. And the person who dried the dishes also swept the kitchen, okay? And washing dishes also included washing those pots and pans that you hated. And I'm not sure if the person who washed the dishes washed the pots and pans or the one who dried the dishes washed the pots and pans, but that was always a big problem. My mother had her boys and girls to do the same thing, so the boys in my family washed dishes too. So we did that, and so we knew a year ahead of time, or any time we wanted to, who was going to wash dishes. And it was a big thing, you know, who was going to be washing dishes on 4th of July, and who was going to be the one to do it on this day. But we didn't have to wash them on Thanksgiving and Christmas, and when the company came, because my mother used her good china and crystal. So dishwashing was a daily chore that had to be done. You also had to, my mother washed on Monday, and when we came home from school on Monday, we had to hang the socks up on the line. She would hang all the big pieces, and all they would be dry, and all these little pieces that were left over, we had to hang them on the back porch to dry. That was something I did not like. I didn't like any of that hot work, so I kept a pain in my side to get out of work. And my mother believed me for years, and I used that for a while. And then I would, I told you I used to sell these pocketbooks, and I was all, and I used to be the letter writer for the people in the neighborhood. We had a number of people in the neighborhood who couldn't read or write. And so, but they always wrote letters to their families in the country. So on Sunday afternoon, different people would tell my mother to tell me to come up there because they wanted me to write some letters. So I would go up and I would write letters for these people, and I would make like 3 cents or 5 cents a letter and all. And then I would put the address and the return address on it and all of that. And then I would have to take the letters to my mother for her to make sure I'd gotten it. But they call it back the letter right. They called it backing letters, and I had backed that letter right. And I got paid. See, they gave me these pennies and all this change and all. So I always had money. And so I would pay my brother sometime to do my work. He would. I used to pay him to drink my milk and all that stuff. So I kept a bankroll, and I just paid people to do things for me. So I was not, you know, I was a real crazy child. Okay. So we did, the dishwashing was the main one, and my brothers did scrub. Sometimes we had a two-story house, so with the inside steps, I had to scrub them some when I was little.
Okay. And how long did you live in the Gainesboro area?
I lived all my life here until I went to college. Well, you know, you call it Gainesboro. That was just Northwest. We called it Northeast, Northwest. It was just where all of us lived. It was because we were backwards and forwards, you know.
And coming back to the area, can you describe some of the ways in which it has changed?
Well, I don't know where I am. Because I certainly would not have been able to find the library. And I knew it sat on the corner, you know, and I would have just been looking and looking and looking. So I don't know anything about this place down here, really. The street that I was reared on is still there. Our house, we kept our house until about, I would guess, about 3 or 4 years before my mother died. And but after we left, after my mother left home, because she stayed there long after, you know, I came home always. I was always home for Christmas or vacation or what have you. But my mother stayed in the house for a long time after my father died in 55. And I guess my mother must have left that house maybe in the 90s, because she was right maybe about 10 years before she died, maybe in the late 80s, I would say. And then I had nieces and nephews who moved in, and they stayed there, three different groups of them. And then finally, we demolished the house, and so it's just the lot is there. And my grandmother's house has now been demolished. And that was on Park Street and 3rd Avenue. Those were the streets there. And the Harrison Museum, that's where I went to elementary school. And I went to 8th grade. We had 8th grade was where we went to. 8th grade was Harrison Annex. So we went from 1st grade to 7th in the middle part of it. On the right-hand side, that's where they had the 8th grade for us. And so we were in 8th grade there. And then we left 8th grade, and we went to Addison, Lucy Addison. And we went to Lucy Addison for 9th through 12th. Then all the kids from Gainesboro, Gilmer and Gainesboro, Kane and Harrison all met up at Addison. So we had one high school for black kids, and we were all there. And when that whole school was just very academically oriented, very, very academically oriented. Our teachers were individuals with master's degrees. Basically, at that time, when blacks couldn't go to anywhere but Virginia State, and if they wanted a master's degree, they had to go out of the state, and the state of Virginia paid them to go. And so during the summer, they would go to Columbia, NYU, and get work on their master's. So we were taught by people, basically, who had master's degrees, and some of them had started working on their doctorates. And in my class, when I was in first grade, I went to school for something like a week, and then they told my brother to come get me, and they put me out of school. And I had to go back home. And in July of that year, Virginia had passed a law that said that you had to be 6 and a half in order to go to school. And I was born in May, so I was not 6 and a half. So they put me out of school. So I was a dropout. No, I was a put out in first grade. So I stayed home with my mother. My Ludie, my baby sister, was in kindergarten, because she was behind me. She was in Miss Wright's kindergarten. And so she was going to kindergarten. So that left me at home with my mother and by myself. And did we ever have a good time? She taught me everything she wanted to teach me. She taught me I never learned how to print. I've always done cursive writing. I was reading everything that you could read and all of that. And so when I marched up to first grade, I went first grade with a fountain pen and a bottle of green ink. And of course, the teachers, of course, were just wonderful teachers, because they let me sit and write all day, and I would write, and they'd put things up on the board, and they would put my writing on the board, and they'd come down and see this little girl who would do all this writing in green ink and a fountain pen. So my not being in school helped a whole lot, and I think I'm still a proponent of children really maturing before they take on crazy academic stuff, you know. But anyway, that's what happened to me. So I didn't get my first big entry, you know, bang into the first grade. But that meant that I was older. And so I kind of sailed on through school. When we got to high school, there were other kids similar in terms of age. And so we were all accelerated kids for the most part. And they decided to let us take 5 classes. in high school, and order to get a credit each year, and that made up for a whole semester. And so we had to go to summer school the summer before our senior year and take an English class, and we did that, and that meant that we came out in May, when we would not have come out until that January. So the whole school system had a flexibility and an encouraging kind of idea, and all of our high school teachers, for the most part, as I told you, were just master teachers. And we, when I went to college, I had my high school notebooks. They would tell us, when you get to college, like with English, you know, when you get to college, you're going to need to know your verbs and your this, that, and the other. So we had, I had a notebook that would be a replica of anybody's grammar book that I took to college with me. And those people, I was bored stiff my freshman year in college because I had had all of this at Addison. And we had taken, one teacher said I could, one of our math teachers said, well, I'll teach you all a little bit of calculus. We didn't even know what the word meant. They were teaching, showing us a little bit of that because we had done trig, geometry, and algebra and all of that. And so it was just a different kind of world, different kind of world. Yes. Yeah.
Okay, what kind of businesses were around that you all, what your groceries from, your clothes from, any kind of businesses?
We didn't buy our clothes from any store. We had no retail stores of that type, but everything else we had, drug stores and our own theater. And so we would go to the theater, the Virginia Theater, and we could go downtown to the Roanoke Theater as blacks. And of course you had to go up the steps in the back and up there. My father says, you don't go, and I would slip and go if I wanted to see something. But, you know, his whole Marcus Garvey thing, no, you don't dare do that. And my mother, of course, she was kind of poor middle of the road, and she didn't know what to do. My dad was so strong about it, you know. But I'd slip and go down to the Roanoke Theater if I wanted to see a movie. And then be very frightened, because the dark would come, and then there you were on that back street, and you had to go around the corner. And I had no business down there and all that kind of good stuff, so I was scared to death and all. But then when I finally got where the lights were, you know, on Campbell Avenue and all, and I was safe, and I come on home, go home. But we had everything, basically, you know, you had neighborhood grocery stores, and some neighborhoods, they were run by blacks, and some neighborhoods for like Northeast, I think, and over like Peach Hill and some of those places. But for the most part, they're Syrians. Oh, I think that's what you call it. We used to call them the Syrians. Yeah, the Syrians. They used to own the groceries, they had the grocery stores and all. And I can remember the ones where, the street that I lived on, we were surrounded by whites. We were about the last street before you got to the West End in Northwest where black people lived. And my block was 500 block. And so that one block was black. In the back of us was, at that time when I was growing up, was Center Avenue, and that 500 block was white. And everything from was white up Loudoun Avenue all the way and all those streets up there. See, Gilmer Avenue was all white up as you went up. So once you did 5th Street, 6th Street, 5th Street, where St. Paul's Church is, that's where the blacks were. And they were kind of like down on Fairfax. Mm-hmm. But then when you went up, and so we were that street, and I told you, we don't know where we live, because that one little block was black. So the Assyrians on the corner had a store, and they had children. And one little girl, Assyrian girl, Josephine, was my age. And I used to play with Josephine, spent a lot of time with her. And I used to help her with her school work. She went to school, Loudoun Avenue School was a white school. And that's on the street I live on. So I couldn't go up the street. I had to go to Harrison. Okay? But she walked up, she would go to Loudoun Avenue. Whenever her father was in his mood, they were Catholics. So he would send her to the Catholic church, but you had to pay to go. And so when he was in bad mood, she went to Loud Avenue when she was in a good mood. She went to Catholic school. And so I'm always still in there teaching her and getting her work, you know, helping her with her work and all. And so we were friends of the children who were in the neighborhood. And so all of them were our friends. And we kind of grew up with them. And because after where I lived, in a way, after school, I didn't live where they lived. See, Janice them lived 8th Street and all that. That's where all my friends were that I went to school with. But we were down in this little area. So after we left school on Friday, you know, I played with these Assyrian kids because I couldn't get to them because I couldn't go out the neighborhood unless it was something special. And if I had to go to Harrison School, well, I saw my friends there. And then when I got in high school, anything that went on at the high school, I saw all my friends. But we were down in that little nook.
Okay, and so how did you get your clothes?
We bought clothes up and down. Oh, Kitty Corner. Okay. Bought clothes for white folks, bought their clothes. Mm-hmm. You remember Kitty Corner? Mm-hmm. Yeah, we bought all that clothes, Kitty Corner. And so anytime you got your things for Christmas and all, you know, I can remember my girlfriend Doris, and one Christmas we had coats. Mine was brown, hers was blue. Mm-hmm. We had a dress and hers was so. I said, oh my goodness. So we would come out looking just alike, and because everybody, and that was where nice clothes were. You just bought nice clothes. We had beautiful. That's, well, Roanoke was the center of the retail district for Southwest Virginia. Everything else was kind of hillbilly. But Roanoke was the center, you know. And so you bought beautiful clothes in Roanoke. Yeah, when I buy shoes and all, when I was in college, they thought I was from New York. Fashion plate.
Mm-hmm. Okay, talk a little bit about your school life. And I know you've talked about it before.
I told you about it. It was just
so
rich.
Harrison
Elementary School, and then to Addison.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And many of our teachers were from Virginia State. And when I finished high school, the state of Virginia gave 2 scholarships for the valedictorian and the salutatorian for every high school in the state of Virginia. You got to a state school. And of course, blacks only went to Virginia State. So I was a salutatorian in my class. And so I got the state scholarship. And so it's when, you know, we start talking about how they recognize kids who do well and all that. That was just a rule, and that was for black kids or white kids. Of course, we went to Virginia State. So I got that scholarship and went to Virginia State from here. But that was one of the scholarships. And I got that scholarship, and I got the Virginia State Alumni Scholarship of $50. And that was a big piece of money for me to have, and helped me a great deal.
Okay.
And the school system in Roanoke was extremely rich.
Okay.
And as I said before, when I got to college, I was shocked at how simple things were. So it was just a repeat of what we had done in high school.
Okay. Continue your education.
Hmm?
Continue your education.
Oh,
process.
I went to Virginia State, as I say. And when I went to Virginia State and stayed 4 years, and I majored in psychology. So that was an unknown. My mother thought I was going to be a teacher. So everybody thought that when I got out of college, I was going to teach school. And I bumped out of college, and I don't have a teaching degree, and I can't be certified. And it was at a time when jobs were unheard. You just couldn't find a job. So all my friends were getting jobs. That finished with me, they were getting jobs teaching school, and I wasn't eligible for a job. And my mother said, what did we send you down there for? What is this psychology? I have no idea. And the family was very angry with me because I was unemployable. And I was willing to work anywhere. I could not find a job. So that summer, I was down on Campbell Avenue, and I saw Nadine Young was a classmate of mine at Virginia State. She lived at Rocky Mount, okay? And so we start talking. I said, what you going to do, Nadine? She said, I got a job. I'm teaching in Rocky Mount. She was a home ec major. And I said, I have not found a job. And I said, I don't know what I'm going to do. I have to go to work. So she said, well, you know, I have a job, and maybe you would like this job. I said, because it's a job with little crazy children. So I said, what? She said, yes, I take care of them. And she said, I bet you I'm going to leave it. And she said, I bet you I could get you that job. And so she said, you meet me. And she told me, we met up, and she said, I'm going to take you down. It was in Hollins. And she said, I'm going to take you down. Said, I'm going to see if I can get her to hire you. I went down to Hollins, Virginia, right down, and there was this school, a private school. It was like a farmhouse, beautiful farmhouse. It sat at the bottom of an apple orchard. And had a little gingerbread house on the side and a beautiful farmhouse. And I went down. This lady's name was Mrs. James, and she introduced Miss James. Miss James had a residential school for, we would call them developmentally disabled children, okay? And when she heard I had a degree in psychology, she said, I'll hire you. She hired me for all of $180 a month. And I worked on every other Sunday, and didn't work on Saturdays, but worked every other Sunday. This was a residential center for rich white children who were developmentally disabled. The one of the Gales, Lewis Gale Hospital, his daughter was there, Theodora. There was a child there who was the a child of the person who owned Myrtle Beach at that time. It was just, they were just wealthy. At that time, they were paying something like $2,500 for just tuition. And then she fed them. Each one of them had their own pediatrician. Person came and collected their shoes to shine their shoes. And one girl wore cashmere sweaters. And I'm like 21 years old or so. And she wore her cashmere sweaters and them dyed to match skirts. And she was a child who sucked and bellowed and carried on. And I would just look at those beautiful cashmere sweaters and want one so badly. And there she was, just salivating all over these pretty sweaters. I was so jealous of her, those pretty clothes. But anyhow, that was the kind of wealth that they had. We would carry them over to Hollins College to different affairs. To concerts and all of that. They were, when I say developmentally disabled, they had what we would call a stigmata. You could look at them and they had the physical stigmata. Some of them were macrocephalic and had the large head and small cretins and so forth. So they were identifiable. They were children that we would call today developmentally disabled. So anyhow, I was there. I had four little boys, and in that group, I was one little boy named Butch, and he gave me my first experience with an autistic child. And you know how many years ago that was. And this whole concept of autism had not even been written about. It was done with this guy, and eventually as I stayed in psychology, I met the person basically who came out the first research paper on autism. But anyway, I had these four little boys, and Butch was the bright one. He obviously was not like the others. So he and I just bonded. He could not speak. He had one underdeveloped eye, and he had all the ritualistic behaviors that go along with autism and so forth. But he bonded with me, and we just became as one. And he was my salvation, on this job and all. And of course, she said that you can't tell people you're teaching. You can't tell people you're teaching because in the state of Virginia, black people can't teach white children. So you have to, Negroes can't teach white children. She used that word at that time. So you'll have to be the companion. So anyway, that was my little job that year. Well, I realized that I couldn't save any money, making all of $130 a month. My mama was giving my mama $50 because I was living at home. They took out, I discovered what Social Security and income taxes were and what did I have. And I was supposed to be saving money to go to graduate school because I realized you can't do it. You have to have a master's degree. So I joined the Army. And I saw a poster one day, basically before I left state. And they were giving commissions to college graduates. And you could go into the Army as a second lieutenant. So I said, well, I think I'll do that because I had to get this money to go to school. So anyway, I joined the Army, and I got a commission. You had to take tests and all of that, and I passed all that stuff. And I became one of 10 blacks from all over the country. It was not but 110 people in there. It was 10 of us blacks, and one another person who was white, but she burnt Mary Surrich, and I need to find her. She's somewhere in this Southwest Virginia area. But Southwest Virginia gave two of the women from this state, because you could only have two, every state had two women. And then that. But anyway, so I went in the military. And I stayed, I was an Army officer in the Army, and I did the whole training school, training bit for other recruits and stayed at Fort Lee. And I stayed there. I got promoted to a first lieutenant. And then I said, you know, I can't stay in this all my life. I got to get busy because I had to become a psychologist. And so I resigned my commission and went to graduate school at Virginia State. I resigned my commission, got out of the Army like on a Friday, went to Virginia State on a Monday, and I did my master's degree there. And at the end of that, my mentor had made contact with a person at Crownsville State Hospital in Maryland and had set up a kind of internship. There were very few internships for people with master's degrees. You had to have a PhD to get to do an internship. So I got that. She hooked that up for me, and I got the internship, and I did. And after that year, got my master's, got my internship finished. Then I was employed at Central State Hospital in Petersburg as a chief psychologist. So I stayed there for 7 years, and I left there and went to Virginia State as an assistant professor in the psych department and stayed there for a long time and finally decided that I was getting involved in a lot of political stuff and getting to be very controversial and all, and decided I needed my PhD in order to survive because they were going to fire me. Yeah, in fact, they did fire me once, but anyway, they had to rehire me. But anyway, I said I better get my meal ticket.
About what year was that?
That I went back to school? Mm-hmm. Gone through civil rights. We started civil rights. I didn't go back. I went back to school in 75. Okay. Yeah, because I was getting in serious trouble. And my mentor was retiring, and she says, I can't be here to protect you, and so you better get that degree. So anyway, I went back to school and went there on a special kind of scholarship because they had never had any. I went to Kent State, and that was just jumping from the frying pan into the fire because this was right after the whole, you know, the shooting at Kent State, and they were still in an uproar of that, and I just fell right in place with all that protesting and all that marching and living in Tent City and all that stuff while I was working on my doctorate. And I got that, came on back to Virginia State. So that's the end of the education. But in, I also went to, I was a National Science Fellow at Harvard for a summer, for two summers. And I also went to Beloit College as a National Science Fellow. And I was out there in Wisconsin. And then I went to some of my African travels was with the American International Studies, something for International Studies, American Group for International Studies. And the reason I was telling you about why I love the mother-child kind of thing, because I studied mother-child relationships, parent-child relationships, and I went from West Africa to East Africa and worked with that kind of research during that period of time. So then all of a sudden I got done and stopped going to school.
What other kind of jobs were available when you were in Roanoke?
Nothing was available
for your parents or your neighbors. You mentioned the railroad.
Mm-hmm. Railroad. Okay. Railroad. Silk mill.
The silk mill. Do you remember when that closed?
I remember when it closed. I don't know the year.
Okay.
But yeah, Silk Bill was a big job, and the railroad was a big job, and that people had, you know, could make a basic living. You know, could make a basic living. Those were the two that I remember most. Of course, a lot of people worked in, you know, in the hotel industry, because hotels they had in Roanoke, and a lot of people worked there, and they had a style of living. My girlfriend's family, they worked in restaurants. They were cooks. And another friend of mine, you know, a young person with me, her father worked at the country club. And so those kinds of places were best. And the women did domestic work, but there were very few jobs for them. And you knew that you were going to, if you're going to get do anything, you go to college or you learn a trade. And so many of our youngsters did have a decent vocational program in high school. And then we also had that business degree, because we had 3 degrees, the academic track and the general, and general vocational, and then the business. So many, again, of my friends, they didn't go to college. They were well equipped to start working, and they went to work to Washington, D.C., so they left Roanoke because there were no jobs as secretaries for them, whereas white kids could come right out of high school and go into it. They were fully capable, but those jobs wouldn't hire them. So segregation hurt in turn a community such as this, because the talented people left, the real talented people left. And so, whereas it you talked about it hurting blacks, it hurted your whole community, all your people in that community, because you didn't have the blending in of all people to be all that they could be. Exactly. They just took their talents and went elsewhere. So you could go to Washington and you could just meet all those women who just went up the ladder, you know, who had learned their business at the high school here. So they were different.
Tell me about your fond memories of this library, which is the Gainsboro branch.
Okay, this is my library. Oh, boy. As I told you, we always read in my family, whatever. My brothers read. My brothers read those True Confessions and all those old kind of books and all. We just read. and nothing was out of thing. But I loved the library was across the street. When we were talking the other night, I realized that this library was what, 42? And that's the year I went to high school, see? And so we had a good library, didn't we, at Addison? And so I did not spend high school time in this library, but my entire elementary school was in that library. And it was on the first floor, and the Y was upstairs, and the library, because I can just see, I can go in the door. And Miss Lee was right here. And the children's library was over on the left. And that was our little nook. And I can just go right now and tell you where these books were and all. And every day in the summer, I would take a bath. And I would put on a clean dress. My mother washed and ironed washed all day Monday and ironed all day Tuesday the girls' clothes. And Wednesday she ironed all the brothers' shirts and daddy's shirts and all the men's clothes. So that was there. And we would have all our dresses. And I would pick me a dress and put it on and walk to the library. And I would have gotten a book, and I'm bringing this book back. And I would go and I would read, go and get me another book, and Miss Lee would close it out, and then I'd walk back home. So that was my journey. Every day this little gal would go. And I was always by myself. This was by my, you know, my privacy kind of thing. And so they had a contest in Roanoke and this was for all children in Roanoke. And that was the child who read the largest number of books. So that summer, I read the largest number of books. And I got $5 for reading that. And I, you know, was rich again. And I shared. I bought a pair of sandals. And I bought those sandals because my foot is extremely narrow, and I never could buy a sandal that would fit. And my daddy would not permit me to buy them, but I had my own money, so I bought sandals that were too big for me, but I thought they were adorable. And I bought a pair of skates, and I bought everybody in the family ice cream cone from the Roanoke Dairy. And then I had a little change left out of my $5. And I won that prize. And I also reached the point where I had read all the books in the children's section of the library. So Miss Lee, I just wandered where the next group of books were. So Miss Lee said, Florence, you come out of there. And I said, but I want to look to see if I want one of these books. So she said, you can't have those books. And so she said, those are books for grown people. Those are adult books. And you can't read those books. So I said, well, what am I going to read? And she said, well, when we get some more books, then you can read them. And I said, well, I need a book tonight. And she said, well, you can't have a book tonight. So I said, but you have to, all of these books are over here, and I haven't read them. So she told me I couldn't read them. So she said, you have to leave the library, because I was holding her a big argument. And Miss Lee was too sweet for anybody to argue with, but I did. And anyhow, I went home, and I told my mama that I couldn't go to the library anymore, and that Miss Lee said that I couldn't read the books and all of that. So Miss Lee did call mama, and my mother, they talked. And so Miss Lee said that I couldn't read the adult books. So Mama said, I'll see to it that she'll take care of them. So she said, no, she says she's not supposed to read them because she's a child and she wouldn't understand them. So Mama said, well, then there will be no harm done because she won't understand them, and let her think she's reading. So I got into the big children's book. I understood more than they thought I understood. I'm going to tell you that. I learned a whole lot of stuff.
Okay.
But you know they were sanitized back then too. So what was the big deal?
Okay. Who were the leaders in your community when you were growing up?
Heroes. Our teachers. Our teachers and our preachers. And we knew all the professional people in the community. You know, we knew all of them. So our teachers were the top leaders and the preachers at the churches. And as I said, Sweet Union and Jerusalem were sister churches. So that was a real close connection. So my sister, who was like a surrogate mother, and my went to Sweet Union, and my mother went to Jerusalem. And the first Sunday, they did communion, joint communion. And this like January, it would be a Sweet Union. In February, it would be a Jerusalem, and they rotated backwards and forwards. And so that meant that I eventually learned the kids who lived in West End and became friends with them also. But the preachers of those churches and all the churches, and I guess as a child, you could call the name of every preacher in town because they had an impact on you and your teachers. And then I remember Harry Penn, who was a dentist, and we knew him. We knew all the Downers. You just knew all your professional people. They were part of the community. You could, you know, so this thing about having heroes and all of that, they were just people who did things in the community. They were your neighbors. And your mother or father had gone to school with some of them, and they were from the community, and they were of the community. So we knew the man who ran the theater, Mr. Neighbors, and we knew this all that's coming to me now. And you knew who owned the drugstore. And then as we grew older and started having a little nightlife, we knew all the clubs and all the folks who were in the club and who were involved with that. We just knew everybody. And they were just people who did this kind of work and made this kind of contribution. So I don't think we thought about them in kind of a hero or heroine or kind of outweigh. They, because of the interaction, they were just people. And they did this kind of thing, and you go to college to do this, and you do something else to do that, and you knew the roots and the pathways and so forth to be. But the center people in your life were those teachers in that school. And I mean, they were real teachers.
And you had a lot of respect for them, didn't you?
Well, yeah, because they had respect for those children. The community respected them. They made a community. They helped to make your community.
Very good. Did anyone in your family, were they in the military, your brothers,
yeah,
sisters?
Yeah, my brother, the brother next to me, he's the youngest boy. I had three brothers. And so my youngest brother, maybe I would say he must have been like 5 or 6 years older than I. And he went into the military at the age of 18. He was drafted. And he was real bright, intellectual, just sharp, bright as he could be. And he finished high school, and right after high school, he was drafted, okay? And we had a big blowout, he and I. Maybe 2 nights before he left, you know, over in something insignificant, you know, we were just fussing and all. And he went into the Army. And he wrote me a letter, about the first letter that came, he wrote to me. And they had, you know, special little envelopes and everything that the military used for them to write on and all that stuff. And he wrote me, and he said he was so sorry that he had mistreated me, and he hadn't treated me nice before he left. And he just wanted me to know that he was sorry, and he was going to send me, they made $21 a month. And he says, and I know you're going to college, and so I'm going to send you $10 a month. Out of an allotment, out of my check. I'm not going to send any money to Mama. I'm going to send my money to you. So this was because he was so scared he was going to get killed in the Army because he had been mean to me and so forth. So he said that was the way he thought maybe he could be safe. So he sent me this. Okay. I get my first check, 10 whole dollars. And so I said, I have to save my money. Somewhere along the way, I learned about the crash, the big crash of the 30s, and when all the banks crashed. And I was afraid, I don't think I got that story right. And so I was afraid that the banks were going to crash with my money. And somewhere along the way, I learned that the post office, you could put your money in the post office, and that would be the federal government. And the only way you could lose your money was if the whole country went down. So I said, well, that's where I'm going to put my money. So I went down to the main post office and told them I wanted to save this money. I discussed it with my mother. She told me to go on. So I went on down there and discussed it. And I deposited my $10, my check, into the postal savings account. And you had a book, and they gave you like a coupon. And you put that coupon in your book, and every time I go down, they would put it and stamp it. And by it came every month. And I can remember, and I never touched a dime of it. And when I finally got ready to go to college, I had something like $180, about 18 months, and I had saved my $10. And child, my mother said, you know, I could spend something like $40 on clothes, and then the rest of the money I was supposed to keep for the tuition to pay each time. So that was my brother and his experience in the Army. Then my middle brother went in the same branch of service, which was the ordnance. And he was stationed in Camp Gordon, Georgia. And he was so mild and very kind of passive and very, very compassionate, you know. And we just kind of ached for him being there because he was smaller than my other brothers in stature and all, but he was there, and he went overseas. They ended up on the same boat going over to overseas in Europe, to Europe, and they were both on the same boat and on there that we didn't realize until they came back. And he would come home on furlough, you know, and I can remember he had some money, you know, and he said, what you want me to buy you? And I don't know why, but I decided I wanted a pair of riding pants and riding boots. And don't tell me why, because I've never been on a horse in my life and never liked any animals and all. But for some reason, and then maybe I read about it in a book, I don't know where I got that image, but he did. He bought me these riding pants and these boots. And I don't think it was a style. I don't remember anybody else walking around and riding much. I don't think it was a style. I don't know where I got it from. But anyway, I had them, green riding pants and brown boots. And I would shine those boots up and just march all over the place. Oh, boy. And then my other brother's in the Navy. And that was my oldest brother. And when he got out of service, and he's the one when I was in college, he used to buy my clothes for college. So my brothers did well and were very much part of college life. And I mean, very much part of the Army life, but all three of them served. And of course, none of them wanted me to go into service when I jumped up and decided to go into service, but they didn't want me to go. Good little girls didn't go in the Army, okay?
Okay. Now, did I ask any questions that you wanted to answer? Mm-hmm. Anything else that you want to tell us about your experience in Roanoke or growing up or your parents or just anything that you would just like to tell us?
We're coming to the end. I may have covered. I don't know.
What about your artwork? Can you just tell us a little bit about your artwork?
Yeah, well, I can talk a little bit, tell you a little about that because it did start in Roanoke.
It's so beautiful.
Okay. I started embroidery in Vacation Bible School. And the piece that I did there was a runner for a hall table. So it was a scarf, long scarf. And it was blue linen. So I liked linen back then. And it was blue linen. And I did it in all in white. And so it was a very, very attractive piece. And in Vacation Bible School, you put your artwork up on the last day, and people came and all to see it. And that was the piece that I did there. And then I learned to, I saw a little girl, a little white girl knitting down at NWPU. They had the most beautiful thread you ever, just beautiful corners with all this thread, you know, they stacked in bins on the wall and all this color. And I just was just gravitated to it. And this little girl was just knitting away and the lady was telling her this and she was telling her that and all. And I said, wonder what is she doing? And so all I could do was just stand and kind of watch. And I went home and I told my mother about the little girl, and she had these two needles and some thread and she was doing this lady. And I told her, I said, if I could get me some of those needles and some thread, I could go down there and get her to teach me. So my mother said, well, no, not really. And I don't want you going down there to ask her to do that, but I'm going to see if we can find somebody who knits, because I know some women who, you know, some people who knit. So anyway, this lady did teach me. Mama got this lady, and she taught me. And it seemed to me, my thinking at that time was that I wasn't learning fast enough. You know, she wasn't really teaching me the way I wanted to be taught, and I wasn't making anything, and I didn't know how to take these. She never did teach me how to take the needles off, the threads off the needles, the stitches off the needles. So anyway, this one day, I just kind of stuck my stuff in my book bag, and on my way home from school, I decided I'd go down NWPU, and I went down there, and that lady was there. So I went up to her, and I pulled my stuff out of my book bag, and I showed her and asked her, could she teach me how, show me how to do it? And she said yes. And so she went ahead, and she showed me, and I took some off, and she showed me again, and she took them off. And so she says, I don't like the way you put them on. Let me show you how to put another way. And she showed me the other way. And I went stepping home. I stopped by my uncle's house first, asked him, did he have 10 cents for me to get some thread, more thread? And he said, yeah, he gave me a dime, and I was struck home. And, of course, my mother, she was not happy because I had done what she told me not to do. But anyway, she was pleased that I had gotten that out of my system. And so from there, I got another dime from my uncle, and I bought a book. And I bought that at Cress's. And that book taught you how to knit, how to crochet, how to tat, how to embroidery, and crewel was in that book. And every kind of stitch work that like that you could do. At that time, embroidery was there, not cross stitch, but that's all cross stitch is embroidery. It's one stitch in embroidery. And so anyhow, I bought that book and found that book. I taught myself how to crochet from that book, and I made sweaters, and I made scarves, and then I made these corday bags, and my mother would line the bags and put the zipper in the bags and all, and then we would sell them to neighbors and would make them, and they would pay me for the thread and a little bit more. And I made bags and things for them. And so then from then on, I just kept doing needlework of all types and all varieties, and just have found it to be a very private, satisfying kind of thing. You know, it's very rewarding. I have never been able to draw. I have never been able to paint. And therefore, I see this somewhat as that yearning that I do have to do paint, to do some type of expression of images, you know, on canvas, if you like. And so the thread gives me that opportunity, and the beads and embellishments now. And so this is the way I create in this realm, and very much so. But I thought art was a waste of time in school, and I thought the little art teachers would come and have us do little stuff in school, and I never thought that what we were doing was meaningful. I thought it was a waste of time. I wanted to be reading, writing, and doing arithmetic and all those other things, and I thought that's what school was for. But so I never, and I realized the reason I didn't like it, I couldn't do it. And when people talk about children, just try. No, I couldn't do that, but I can do this.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah, I can do this.
And it's very beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dr. Farley.
Yeah, it's nice sitting in this room with all of you.
Thank you.
And it's a joy to be able to. I never thought about thinking about having any show, you know, because I don't think this is art. I didn't think it was until other people have told me that. But I guess this will be a very pleasant memory, and it kind of ties things together for me since it all started here. And I did have it in the library in Petersburg, and because I had kindly taken Petersburg as my home after I got married, and stayed there and invested my adult life there. It was kind of nice to come home. It was really beautiful to come home, and certainly beautiful to come to the Gainsborough Library.
Well, we thank you for coming to the Gainsborough Library,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, so that's where that goes.
Thank you so much for her. This is exquisite. I can't say enough about it. And everyone who has been here just love. I mean, they just ooh and awe at each piece. So if you have missed the art exhibit, you have missed something. Thank you, Dr.
Thank you.
Farley.
Thank you.
Thank you.